You're all here, so why should we wait any longer to get started? Thank you all for being here. This is a nice turnout for our first event in our fall 2016 series on death and dying. Beautiful night. You could be outside walking around Grays Lake, though probably sweating as you do so. And it's kind of stuffy in here, isn't it? I'll see if I can do something about that. Especially, yeah. That's better. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake University, and I run the Comparison Project, which is the sponsor of the event tonight. The Comparison Project does many things. We have a lecture and dialogue series, which you're part of tonight. We pursue a single theme or topic through different religions of the world over the course of 2 years. We're halfway through our programming on death and dying. We'll be continuing that for this academic year and then engaging in some comparative reflections over what we've learned for 2 years. And then next fall, moving on to a new topic. We'd like ideas. Cosmology is one possibility, or miracles, or Svetlana, what was it? Love.
And life.
What?
And life.
Love and life. That's nice. It's not going to happen. It has no teeth. We also work with local lived religion in Des Moines. Our students work to facilitate the creation of digital stories that show the practice of religion in local communities. Those digital stories are on our website, along with some guides to local religious communities. Students are also working on a photo illustrated documentary about 15 religious communities, 3 synagogues, 3 churches, 3 mosques, 2 Hindu temples, 2 Buddhist temples, 2 Sikh temples. That book will be coming out in April. We'll have a big book launch for that and all. And we're also going to do something while Krista Tippett's here on November 15th regarding the book documentary project. So look for that. Lots of work, and that requires lots of money, as you all know. We're grateful for the support that we have from now 8 different sources: Drake's Center for the Humanities, Drake's Principal Financial Group for Global Citizenship, the Medbury Fund, Humanities Iowa, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation. I saw Dick just come in. Thanks, Dick. The SLAE Fund for Social Justice, and our special series sponsor for last year and this year on death and dying, who better than a funeral home? Isles Funeral Homes is our special series sponsor, and we'll be doing 2 of our events this coming semester in their Duns Chapel, our 2 community dialogues, which this year will focus representatives of refugee and immigrant communities. I saw Robin at some point. Robin, thanks. Thanks for the support from Isles. I also want to thank some people who helped make the program happen. There's my colleague Leah Kalmanson sitting next to her, Mary Gottschalk, who does a whole heck of a lot of work on this. Kayla, our former administrative assistant. We need a new one in case anyone wants to work as our administrative assistant. And I have a whole team of student research assistants this year. Shay is here. Nathan is here. Is there anyone else here missing? Grace is here. Thanks to all of you. There's more information about what we do outside in our brochures and a little announcement about the picture book. We're required to take attendance at our events through Humanities Iowa. I'm going to pass this around. If you'd be so kind, at least to write your name. If you want to be on our emailing list or Humanities Iowa's emailing list, you can also write your email address down. Let's move this along, shall we? When we put together this program on death and dying, I guess a year and a half ago, one of the names we kept hearing, someone whom we absolutely, absolutely, absolutely had to come speak at Drake, was Rabbi Elliot Dorf, sitting next to me right now. Rabbi Dorf is a rector and Solon Ann Dorf Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at American Jewish University. He's also visiting professor at the UCLA School of Law. He was ordained as a rabbi in 1970 from the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, and he received his PhD later, 1 year later, in philosophy from Columbia University. He's published, and the number keeps going up, so I think as I was actually looking online, the number went up. He's published 13 books, co-written another 14, and authored over 200 articles on Jewish ethics, philosophy, laws, and customs. Since 1984, he served on the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, and since 2007, he has been its chair. Having written many legal rulings on Jewish law in the conservative tradition, he's become a leading voice of the conservative movement on topics such as human sexuality, poverty, and ethics. He has also served on the Ethics Committee of Hillary Clinton's Healthcare Task Force in 1993, testified before the President's National Bioethics Advisory Commission on Human Cloning and Stem Cell Research in 1997 and 1999, and served on the U.S. Surgeons General Task Force to create a call to action for responsible sexual behavior in 1999 and 2000. And the list goes on and on and on. To sum up, as Jared Bernstein said in trying to communicate to some of the Jewish students on campus about why they should come tonight, he's a big deal. Tonight he will be speaking to us about a lecture called A Time to Be Born and A Time to Die from Ecclesiastes 3:2, A Jewish View of the Modern Medical Complexities of Dying. Please join me in welcoming Elliot Dorf.
First, I want to tell you what a big deal I am. We have four children and eight grandchildren, and one time when my three-year-old granddaughter, when my granddaughter was 3 years old, there was teacher-parent conferences, and my wife was teaching at the time, and my son and daughter-in-law were busy. It happened to be a day that I was not teaching, so I had Zoe for the day, and after lunch, she wanted a popsicle, and I said to her, "Zoe, do you always get dessert after lunch?" And she said, "No, but you're supposed to spoil me." See, that's my mission in life. Forget about all this other stuff. Okay. I'm a big deal because I can give her a popsicle. Anyway, I want to do two things as introductory remarks, and then we're going to get to actually death and dying. The first introductory remark is that medicine has absolutely exploded in its abilities to cure us of a number of diseases that would have taken our lives long before, and also to sustain us even when we have a lethal disease. So that means, among other things, that and most of that is a function not of the things that you read about in the newspapers, most of that is public health measures. Things like you have indoor plumbing. I was at a conference in southern India one time, and you see these open sewage pits and flies all over the place, and you sort of wonder why people are not sicker than they are. Also, things like vaccinations. How many of you ever had measles? Yeah. I had measles in 1955. The reason why the younger people did not is because in 1963, we got the vaccination for measles. So, you don't see it anymore. How many of you had chickenpox? See, that's because that vaccination didn't come until 1993, and it's not used as often as just a general thing that a pediatrician does. Health education is a major reason why we live longer. And by the way, we really do live longer. In 1900, in the United States, life expectancy was about 45. 100 years later, in 2000, it was 75.8. We almost doubled life expectancy in 100 years. Another piece of this is health education. I mean, you're taught the problems of smoking and alcohol abuse and drug abuse. You're taught that you need to exercise, that certain foods are healthy and others are not. On smoking, for example, when I was growing up, that was the cool thing to do. But then the Surgeon General came out with his report in 1964 about the dangers of the cancerous dangers of smoking and others as well, and then later on secondhand smoke. What has happened is that a number of states have adopted rules that make it hard to smoke. In California, you can't even smoke on Venice Beach, all right, let alone in enclosed environments. And it was, I mean, that if it makes it hard, and you also raise the taxes and all of that, if it makes it hard to smoke, less and less people are smoking. The thing is that, just for the fun of it, the smoking rate in the United States today is about 21%. What state in the union do you think has the highest smoking rate? Not Texas? Not, I would have thought North Carolina. No, it's Kentucky. What state in the union has the lowest smoking rate? Yeah, you got it. Utah, of course. Because, Mormons don't smoke, and that's a large percentage of the population. Second lowest rate is in California, actually, which is a much larger population, a much more diverse population. But it's largely these kinds of legal things and these kinds of educational things that have led us to live longer lives. Second most important thing is antibiotics. I am a beneficiary of that. I inherited a weakness in my bronchial tubes from my father's side of the family. My father had a brother who, at age 20, in the 1920s, got pneumonia and got bronchitis that became pneumonia, and then he died. I've had bronchitis about 15 times in my life, and each time it's whatever the antibiotic is, and here I am. Right? It really is a wonder drug, but we overuse them, especially with animals. But we overuse them with human beings as well, so we have to cut down on that, or otherwise they won't be effective anymore. But that's the second most important reason why we live much longer. It's only in a tertiary way that some of the things you read about, like microsurgeries and heart transplants and things like that, that have affected our life expectancy. Now, what that means is that questions that my parents never had to face, I have to face. Because until very recently in human history, there was very little that doctors could do to help you avoid, to cure your illnesses, especially serious ones, and to help you avoid dying. You have to remember that a lot of these vaccinations, I just gave you an example of two of them. The polio vaccine was 1956. I had a friend who had polio. I'm 73, by the way. You don't have to guess. You need to know that this is like yesterday in human history, that all of these developments in medicine have taken place. What, as a result of that, you get the Kantian question. Immanuel Kant pointed out that if you cannot do something, then you never have to ask whether you should, because you can't. But if you can do something, then you do have to ask whether you should, because there are all kinds of things that you can do that you should not do. You can smoke, you can overeat, and so on, right, that you should not do. And that question about, now that we can extend life in a whole variety of different ways, most of the time we would say, go for it, right? We should. But are there times and are there cases in which we shouldn't do it? We should step back and let nature take its course. Maybe make sure that the person is feeling comfortable, enduring as little pain as possible. But otherwise, we're not doing the patient, let alone family, anybody else, a favor by intervening in ways that might work for a day or two or a week or a month or something, but ultimately is not really in the patient's best interest, especially if the patient is comatose or something in that order, or if the patient has, let's say, pancreatic cancer and is in a lot of pain, some of which can be moderated, you don't want to have any of these diseases, these lethal diseases, but that's one that you really want to avoid if you could. So that's the first introductory point, that because medicine has developed so much over the course of the last 50, 80 years, the Kantian question becomes more and more acute. The fact that we can do something doesn't necessarily mean that we should. And so we have to ask very, very pointed moral questions about whether we should intervene and when we should stop. The second introductory point is the following. The Jewish tradition, like every other tradition, didn't know about all of these medical developments. As a matter of fact, the Jewish tradition has a total of four sources that even contemplate that human beings could help to extend somebody's life. And they are not at all the kind of thing, the kinds of questions that we, kinds of situations that we are talking about. So, for example, there is a, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, when the Jews revolted against Rome from 132 to 135 and lost, there were the Hadrianic persecutions. The Emperor Hadrian made it a capital offense to teach Judaism. And there are 10 rabbis that are recorded as having done it anyway and being being executed by the Romans in particularly painful ways. Rabbi Akiva was flayed, literally. The one that's the story that's important for our purposes is Hananiah ben Tradyum. He is being burned at the stake, and they put tufts of wool soaked in water on his chest in order to delay the dying process and make it more painful. And somehow or another, he's having this, while he's on the stake, is having a conversation with his students. And they say to him, Rabbi, open your mouth so that you can inhale the flames and die faster. And he says, no, the one that gave life has to be the one that takes it. In other words, he doesn't think that he has the permission to commit suicide. Then they say to him, well, may we bribe the executioner, a Roman pagan, presumably, may we bribe the executioner to at least remove the tufts of wool? And he said, you may. And the executioner, apparently no fool, says to him, well, if I do this, will you promise me a place in the world to come? And he says, yes. And he removes the tufts of wool and increases the flames. That's a really hard part of this story. And Rabbi Hananiah ben Tradyum dies. The executioner jumps into the flames and dies himself. And then there's a voice from heaven that comes out and says, Rabbi Hananiah ben Tradyum and the executioner have merited a place in the world to come. Now, that's not a hospital bed by a long shot, okay? Right? I mean, one of the real problems here, it does talk about delaying the dying process and in terms of tufts of wool soaked with water, and it talks about when you should remove them. But it's not the kind of medical situation that you would hope for in a precedent. Let me give you another one. Rabbi Yehuda is dying. And he is having a lot of trouble urinating and defecating. And his disciples are praying for that he stay alive. But his handmaid sees how much pain he is enduring, and they're on the bottom floor, and she's at the top floor, and she drops a pot so that it makes a loud noise, and they interrupt their prayers, and in that moment he dies. Now, prayer is not usually something that we talk about as a medical cure, right? But, I mean, I believe in prayer. I'm a rabbi, all of that, right? But you don't come to me to cure your disease, okay? I'll leave it at that. You shouldn't, at any rate, okay? But the point is that, again, this is one of only four sources. And what does this say? I mean, both the Hananiah ben Tradyum story and this one are used extensively in contemporary Jewish treatments of end-of-life issues. I'll give you a third. The fourth one is not all that important. This comes much later. This is the 13th century. A man is dying, there are two different versions of the story. There's a window next to his bed that's open, and there's a breeze coming through the window. Or the other version of it is that there's a knocking sound coming through the window. And the people there judge that if you stop the breeze or the knocking sound, then he would be able to die. And the question is, may you shut the window? And the answer is, in this particular story, is not only may you, but you should. Now, what comes out of these stories? See, given the fact that these are not really medical stories, how do you use them with any degree of methodological authenticity and at least, some kind of coherence to make medical decisions? The one thing that seems to come out of them, and which ultimately gets into the 16th century Jewish code of law called the Shulchan Aruch, is that on the one hand, you may not hasten the dying process. because your body belongs to God, not to you, in the Jewish tradition. So you may not destroy that which is not yours, namely God's property. And that's part of the reason in the Jewish tradition that you have to take care of your body, right? I mean, just to give you a contrast, in the American tradition, who owns your body? In American law, you do. And this was especially made clear in the Nancy Cruzan decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1990, in which the Supreme Court ruled, unanimously actually, that individuals may refuse any medical interventions. You don't have the right to insist upon them, but you do have a right to refuse them, okay? Because it's your body, you can do with it as you will, as long as you don't hurt anyone else. So here we go. Here's my Achilles heel, ice cream. What about eating a half a gallon of ice cream every night of the week? And as long as you're doing it, might as well be mint chocolate chip or cherry Garcia. That stuff is so good. anyway, now from an American point of view, I can do this. I mean, it's my body, my problem, right? And I'm not hurting anyone else, at least not directly. But from a Jewish point of view, I don't have a right to eat a half a gallon of ice cream every night of the week because I have to take care of this body of mine which belongs to God. Well, the same sort of thing happens on end-of-life issues. Namely, you may not hasten the dying process, but given especially the story from the 13th century and also Hananiah ben Tranyan, you should not delay the dying process either. So you may not hasten it, but you should also not delay it. That's the sort of general rule that comes out of the tradition. But these kinds of things become very, very hard to determine, given modern medicine. At what point do you remove a heart-lung machine or artificial nutrition and hydration? How do you classify that in the first place? At what point do you give up, as it were? And what is the criterion by which you give up that would justify your giving up trying to keep a person alive? Because the what's going on here in the background are two very important but in some ways contradictory theological commitments. On the one hand, starting with the Garden of Eden story, the Jewish tradition is very much aware of the fact that we are mortal. We don't live forever. Later on, Ecclesiastes will say, there's a time to be born and there's a time to die. So there's a certain realism about the fact that we are not going to live forever. On the other hand, the Jewish tradition is very aggressive in its attempts to try to prevent diseases and to cure them. Sometimes the way that I put it, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, is that there's been a love affair between Judaism and medicine for at least 2,000 years. A lot of rabbis during the Middle Ages were also physicians. Maimonides is probably the most famous of them, but there were a lot of them. Now that doesn't happen so much because going to rabbinical school still takes more or less the same amount of time, but going to medical school is a whole different story. I was once at a conference at the University of Virginia, and the dean of the medical school said, in Mr. Jefferson's medical school, how long do you think it took to become a doctor? What would you guess? You got it. 1 year. 1 year. Because they couldn't teach you anything more than that. Right? As a matter of fact, the undergraduate program at the University of Virginia during his time, remember he created the University of Virginia, was a year of medicine, a year of law that made you a lawyer, a year of humanities, and a year of social sciences. Not a bad undergraduate curriculum, actually, right? But it made you both a lawyer and a doctor. Now, of course, there's 4 years of medical school and 4 years of pre-med and then 4 years of medical school and then a year of internship and usually 3 years of residency and postdocs and all of that stuff, right? That's why there are not a lot of rabbis who are both MDs and rabbis. But the tradition has been really committed to trying to both avoid disease and if it happens, to try to cure it. So what you're getting in these end-of-life issues is the kind of contrast, the bucking heads, as it were, of these two principles. On the one hand, we're mortal. And on the other hand, we're supposed to try to cure diseases if we can't avoid them in the first place as much as we possibly can. So what happens in contemporary times, I'm talking about the last 30, 40 years, Well, actually, beginning with Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz's book in 1959, the first full book on Jewish medical ethics. He was an Orthodox rabbi. He's passed on. He was an Orthodox rabbi. He was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. He was an American, but he was then he moved to Ireland, and he was the chief rabbi of Dublin, and then became the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. And he wrote the first book on Jewish medical ethics, and I actually heard him give a talk one time, and he said the reason why he did that was because in Dublin, with a very high, very large Catholic population, the Catholics were dealing with beginning of life issues and end of life issues a lot, and they kept on asking him, what did the Jews say about this, right? And that's ultimately how he came to write his book. Subsequently, since 1959, there have been a number of other rabbis across the denominational spectrum that have written about end-of-life issues. Their approaches to it very much mirror the ideological commitments of the different movements. In case you don't know, the Orthodox are on the right, the conservative, despite the name, are in the middle, and the Reform are on the left end. In the Reform movement, the primary principle is individual autonomy. And so if you look at what Reform rabbis have written about not only end-of-life issues but other things as well, there is guidance that they get from the tradition, but in the end, it's up to the individual to decide whether to take that guidance or not. Okay? And as a result, even when you look at the Advanced Directive for Healthcare, do you know what that is? When you look at the Advanced Directive for Healthcare that the Reform movement has published, what you have is it's a grid, and going down the grid are a whole series of possible interventions. And along the top is, I don't want it, I probably don't want it, I don't know, I probably want it, and I really want it. Right? It's I who want it, right? So it's individual autonomy. On the other end of the spectrum, if you talk to the Orthodox, well, first of all, you need to know that the Orthodox are not one community. They're more splintered than the other two movements are. They're the modern Orthodox, and there are a whole series of sects of Hasidic Jews or Haredi Jews. Hasidic Jews and Haredi Jews, those are two different things. So you can't say the Orthodox say this. But what is true about the Orthodox is that their commitment is to the text of the tradition. And one way or another, they're going to get guidance from, or at least claim to get guidance, from the text of the tradition. Often, I would say, this is Elliot Dorf talking, as a conservative rabbi, I would say that a lot of what the Orthodox are doing is eisegesis rather than exegesis. That is, reading into the text rather than deriving meaning from the text, right? And because there aren't a lot of texts that they can use to begin with. I just gave you three of them, right? So, and they tend to be, I mean, the general tenor of the Orthodox is to be, the answer is no, unless you can find a reason to say yes, okay? But you have to really work hard to find a reason to say yes, right? That's the general way of doing things. When I first came to the American Jewish University, I was the registrar, and we had a program with UCLA for honor students at UCLA who could take some of our courses toward their BA degree at UCLA. And as registrar, I had to talk to the registrar at UCLA to give her the list of courses and all of that. And she was wonderful. Annette Seppmeyer, I still remember her name. And she was really great. So I went after that conversation. I talked to the president at the time of our university, and he said to me, there are basically two kinds of people in the world. Those who want to say yes, and those who want to say no. Right? And if you want to say no, which is what most of the Orthodox do, there are real exceptions here, but where most of the Orthodox want to do, then you can find ample reason to say no. I don't want to do this. Who am I? I'm a human being. How can I do this when God created my body and I have to sustain it no matter what? But even within the Orthodox, there is a spectrum of positions. So on the very right end, you get somebody like Rabbi J. David Blyth at Yeshiva University, who basically says no to everything, except for, really interestingly, issues having to do with deaf people. And then I found out why. He has a son who is deaf, right? And you need to know that that's not unusual. That when people come to make decisions, their whole histories are behind those decisions. And it's not, I teach in a law school, right? It's not the law itself that always is determinative in terms of how a person interprets it. It's very much that person's autobiography. And whom does he know? I mean, you just saw this with Justice Kennedy, right? Appointed by President Ronald Reagan. And yet he had since the 2003 the decision of the Supreme Court, and then of course last year, he has been in the forefront for gay rights. Right? Now, why is he in the forefront for gay rights? Because he had a gay legal partner back in Sacramento before he became a judge. Right? So, I mean, these are the kinds of things that you're going to get in any legal decision, including those within the Jewish tradition. So among the Orthodox, you get J. David Blight, who would say, you may not stop trying to save somebody until the person dies. You have to do absolutely extraordinary, ordinary, doesn't matter. You've got to do absolutely everything under the sun in order to try to keep a person alive. Even if that person has been comatose for years, even if that person is dependent upon artificial nutrition and hydration and the heart-lung machine, whatever, until the last breath comes by nature, you have to do everything. Then I'm just going to give you two or three positions within the Orthodox world. Sort of a central position within the Orthodox world is that of Moshe Tendler, who's a biologist and also a rabbi at Yeshiva University. And he does say, that you don't have to intervene, you don't have to intubate, you don't have to put tubes in a person. But if you do put tubes in a person, then you may not remove them. Right? So basically, his position is that you don't have to intervene. You may allow nature to take its course. But once you have intervened, you have to follow through to the very end. Right? And I personally think that that's just crazy. I'll just say it not very politically correctly. But because any other time in your life, if a physician tries some kind of intervention and it's not working, you want that physician to stop it. Because every intervention has its side effects, and most of those side effects are not good, right? So why should that be different at the end of life? If you, let's say, you attach the person to a heart-lung machine in the hopes that you would be able to wean that person from the machine and enable that person to breathe and on his or her own, but then it turns out that you can't, you try weaning, and it just doesn't work. Well, at some point, the choice is you leave the person on the heart-lung machine for whatever, years. And by the way, who pays for that? You and I do, okay? Because that comes from taxpayer funds ultimately. So you either remove the machines, or you don't. And the question really is, how do you make those kinds of judgments? And the fact that and once you intervene, you may not stop. I mean, that would only make sense if human beings never make mistakes, right? Once you do X, you may not do anything other than X. Well, if that were true, I think everybody in this room would be stuck with some mistake you made a long time ago and really want to stop it, right? All the more so when you're talking about medical interventions that have these negative side effects. There are yet others, again, on the left end of the Orthodox world, that would say that we should by all means try to cure diseases when they occur, but we have to recognize that we are mortal, and that consequently there are limits that to some extent when you are intervening, what you are doing in some cases, right? What you are doing is delaying the dying process, the natural dying process. Of course, all of medicine is that, right? When I take antibiotics, right, for bronchitis, I am delaying the dying process. If I were my uncle, I would have been dead by now, right? And not subjecting you to this. But the point is that, all of medicine is that to some extent, right? And I think with that position within the Orthodox world is arguing, I have a lot of sympathy for, but how do you determine which of these interventions are simply delaying the dying process and which of these these interventions are, in fact, at least hold out some hope for giving the person more life, more years, whatever. In the conservative movement, believes that Jewish law is binding, but that Jewish law develops over time, and that in our own time as well, in order to be authentic as Jews, we have to both take the tradition seriously and then use a lot of judgment and a lot of wisdom in terms of how we apply the tradition to modern circumstances. That said, within the conservative movement, there are two rabbinic rulings that were approved by the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, one by Rabbi Avram Reisner and one by me. We agree on about 80, 85% of the issues. So we agree, for example, that if you do intubate, you may both withhold and withdraw interventions, whether they be pills or whether they be machines or surgeries or whatever. Whatever way in which you are intervening in this disease, you may try it if you think you have a good chance of success in order to keep the person alive and maybe hopefully functioning as well. But if it turns out that you can't, then you may withdraw it. We both agree on that. We both agree that people should fill out advanced directives for healthcare. And by the way, you know, this is my own deal. When should you fill out an advance directive for healthcare?
Today.
Exactly right. This is really my shtick. I think that you should fill out an advance directive for healthcare when you get your driver's license. Right? I have yet to convince anybody to do that, but it's because for several reasons. First of all the hard cases that end up in the courts are young people who never even dreamed that they were going to die tomorrow. Right? I mean, we're talking about the Nancy Cruzan decision. She's a woman in her mid-20s. Elizabeth Bouvet, also a woman in her 20s, right? Karen Ann Quinlan from back in the 1970s, also a woman, I think, late teens, early 20s when it first started, right? So this would be a way of getting people who are driving, because that really increases your risks, getting people who are driving to at least express what they would want under these circumstances. It also, I hope, would give teenagers a certain sense of the responsibility that they're taking on themselves when they start driving. But certainly, if you haven't done it then do it now, because that's the only way in which your loved ones are going to be able to know what you would want. I do a lot of consulting for families who are dying, and I would say that 85% of the time, what I'm doing is relieving guilt. Right? The person didn't leave an advance directive and therefore didn't say, I want this, but I don't want that. Right? They never said, I don't want that. And so the children are very often left, the adult children are very often left with, we don't know what to do. I'll give you a case in point that I'm thinking of. Three adult children. Two of them think that they should remove life support from mom because there's no chance of her recovering in any meaningful way. One of them wants to keep the machines going, everything going. The one who had the worst relationship with mom during their lives together, right? And I actually heard her say at the end of it, once this is all done, mom and I didn't get along very well during our life together, but in the end, I was there for her and you guys killed her. Now, you want to avoid that, okay? All right? You don't want siblings to have that kind of relationship that spills over, or is given extra power by the way in which they deal with mom or dad's dying, right? So you need to fill out an advance directive. And by the way, how do you do that? Well, you need some medical knowledge in order to do that. So you should do it with a group that is meeting with a physician or somebody who knows these things, a medical social worker, who can tell you what these things are. I remember that I did this. My father-in-law died, and my mother-in-law felt very guilty about it because in the end she had to decide to remove life support from him. Even though, I mean, she was talking to me all the time, and I said, you know, there's just no chance of his survival, and all you're doing is delaying the dying process, and there's very good Jewish grounds for removing the life support. So what she would consider a weak moment, she gave in. But then she felt really guilty. So I said to her, all right, let's fill out an advance directive for yourself. So she said to me, well, I want everything. So I said, okay, well, let's start from the beginning. And I described a particular scenario to her that is fairly common in the dying process. And she said, oh, I know, I wouldn't want that. And then the second scenario, oh, I wouldn't want that. It turns out she wants nothing, okay, right, except to be made comfortable in the end, right? So you have to have somebody there to at least describe what we're talking about when we're talking about interventions, right? Some of these interventions involve breaking open a person's chest. That's not something you, you know, want to do, certainly not frivolously. You might want to do it ultimately for some reason, for a good reason, but you at least have to see these things, right, for what they are. And then, once you have filled out your advance directive, what do you do with it? Well, you give a copy to your primary physician, you give a copy to your family lawyer, and you give a copy to every one of the relatives that you have that you think will be involved in your decision. And you should have a family meeting in which you say the things that you don't want to have said, so that when it comes time for your children to make these decisions, whoever it is that is the first, you know, the first surrogate decision maker, will be able to say to his or her siblings, look, you were there when mom said this or when dad said this. This is not necessarily the way that I want to die, but she or he actually said this. And consequently, don't blame me. This is what mom wanted or this is what dad wanted. Right? You need to have that kind of family meeting. And how do you, nobody wants to talk about death, right? So how do you do this? Well, you make out this advance directive. You pass out copies. Jews don't want to talk about death any more than anybody else, but Jews know how to unpack a text, right? So if you have a text in front of you, you can say, well, what do you mean by this, and what do you mean by that, and so on down the line, right? So Rabbi Reisner and I both agree that you should fill out advance directives. Both of us agree on hospice care. Do you know what hospice care is? It's where you are still getting medical care, but the objective of the care is to keep you comfortable because it has been adjudged that there is no way to cure your illness, right? And hospice care is increasingly part of the American environment on death and dying. I think that's a very healthy thing. I was on the first Jewish Hospice Commission, and one of the people on it was a physician from Cedars-Sinai who was a brain surgeon. This was 1985. I think it's advanced since then. But he said that 75% of the brain tumors I see, I can't cure. But I'm here because I know that I can care, even if I can't cure. And that's what hospice care is about. It's about getting physicians, nurses, social workers, rabbis in our case, and in particular family members and friends, to be with the dying person on an ongoing basis. Because dying and getting sick over a long period of time is a very isolating phenomenon, right? I mean, you don't see the same people you normally see. You don't see your friends and family. Yes, there is a mitzvah, a commandment in the Jewish tradition for visiting the sick. But it's very hard for people to come to visit the sick, right? Why don't you like to go to hospitals? I'll just say, why don't I like to go to hospitals to visit the sick? Why not? Yes, you realize that you're going to die. It takes away your cover of immortality. Good. What's another reason? I'm sorry? You become depressed. Yes. Hospitals are not joyous places usually, except in the maternity ward, right? Okay. What about what else? Why else don't you like to visit the sick? Pardon me? You don't know what to say. Right on. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. And another reason is the schlep of it all, right? You have to go to some place, go to the hospital, you have to pay for parking, you have to go into the patient's room, right? You have to find it, first of all. Hospitals are mazes, right? You have to find the patient's room. And what's likely to be the case when you walk into the patient's room? The person is asleep or out for tests. And neither one of those is going to encourage you to come back, right? So the Jewish tradition says that you are required to visit the sick. because it knows that most of us don't want to, right? And why not? Because illness has several different factors to it. Number one, it is isolating. And now I'm going to quote to you an ancient Jewish source. People who need people are the luckiest people in the world, okay? All kidding aside, we human beings have a real need for interaction with other people. I mean, short of execution or torture, what is the harshest penalty in prison? Solitary confinement, right. Okay, because we really need, you need some time on your own, right? But we all need that kind of interaction. And if you're in a hospital or a nursing home or something and nobody comes to see you, that's really depressing. It also diminishes your ability to try to do what you need to do to live, right? So that's the first aspect of death, that it is, of dying, I should say, that it is isolating. Second aspect of death is that it is infantilizing, right? You are not able to do the same kinds of things that you were otherwise able to do. And a third aspect of dying is that it is debilitating. That's almost by definition, right? So what does the Jewish tradition say about what do you say when you come in? What do you do when you come into a hospital room? First of all, sit down. Why? Because if this is the person in bed and this is you, what does that body language say? Yeah, say it louder, please. Yes, I'm more empowered. I have power, I'm good, you're not. And that's the last thing you want to say to a person who's sick, because they already feel debilitated. So you sit down. As a matter of fact, Maimonides, a 12th century doctor and physician and rabbi, did not know about raised beds. So mattresses were on the floor, and he says you actually have to lie down on the floor so that your head is not above the patient's head, right? Because you don't want to strengthen the sense of disability that the patient has. And now what do you talk about? I can tell you out of a lot of experience that both patients and visitors tire of talking about the weather and the food in about 3 seconds. Okay? So what do you talk about? Because illness is infantilizing, you want to talk about the same adult topics that you would normally talk about with that patient. So if you normally talk about sports. Politics, novels, movies, whatever, show business, right? Whatever it is. Whatever it is that you would normally talk about with that patient, talk about that with the patient now. What's the subtext? What are you saying to the patient when you talk about those same topics? You're still my friend. You still count. You're still worth my interacting with you. Right? That's really important when you're talking about a person who is dying, because they lose a sense of self-worth. They lose a sense of being able to do things, and they lose a sense of abilities altogether. Right? And then finally, the fourth aspect of illness that I want to suggest to you is that most of us are not going to die of acute illnesses. You have a sudden heart attack and you die. You're in a car accident and you die. The vast majority of us are going to die of chronic illnesses over long periods of time. So what do you do when you go to visit somebody over a long period of time? One thing you can do that comes out of the Jewish tradition in the Middle Ages is create what's called an ethical will. Originally, so you have three kinds of wills, as it were, right? One is a will for the disposition of your property. That you talk about with your lawyer, okay? A second is what's sometimes called an advance directive, otherwise called a living will. Sometimes an advance directive has a proxy statement. If I'm not able to make my own decisions, I want person A to make those decisions. And if A is either unwilling or unable, I want person B. If not person B, person C. You have it witnessed or notarized, whatever your state requires, and that's part of the advance directive. The other part of the advance directive is sometimes called the living will, in which you express your desires over a number of different ways in which people commonly die. You can't possibly predict how you're going to die, but at least there are some common ways in which people die and some questions that commonly arise. So you answer those kinds of questions. So that's the living will. The third kind of will, this ethical will, started out in the Middle Ages, in which parents would write to their children about this. These are the values that I try to live in my life. I may not have succeeded, but I hope that you at least recognize that those are the values that I stood for. Now, living wills can be, ethical wills don't have to be a letter. You know, it can be any way you record anything. And in particular, what you want to be put in that is family history. I unfortunately didn't think to do this when my parents were alive, but I did it with my in-laws. I sat with my father-in-law. At that time, it was a videotape. And what are your earliest memories? Who was around at the time, right? What did you do? What did your parents do? What did your grandparents do? All of that kind of thing, right? You just start asking questions as if you were interviewing somebody that you needed to know a lot about that person's life. You know, if you came to this country, when did you come to this country? How did that work? Where did you come to? All of that kind of thing. If you went, what was your schooling like? How did you decide to do what you ultimately did in life? Where did you meet your spouse if you were married? All of those kinds of questions, right? My wife didn't want to hear those stories anymore, so I was the one that heard those stories with this tape. And when I played it for her, she said to me, "My father didn't tell the story that way the last time I heard it." Okay, but that's okay, because this recording is not for public consumption. This recording is not so much for the children, actually, but for the grandchildren, right? To get a sense of their roots. And if you come with some kind of recording device to somebody who's in hospital care, hopefully, you do this before that, before hospice, that you come and you're going to come for an hour, as 3 days a week or something. That's a reason to get up in the morning, to come to sit for an hour with somebody who's coming in to visit you and is recording your family history. Right? Because that's a legacy that you can give to your descendants. And it's the kind of thing that really can make a difference in a patient's life if there is something that really matters in that person's day. Okay? So, and that's because of the fourth aspect of illness, which is that it's boring. Okay? Especially over a long period of time. So that what you want to do is try to be a programmer, as it were, not a programmer for computers, but I mean somebody who creates programs for or creates things for that person to do despite that person's disabilities and to have a lot of interactions with them. That's all under the commandment in my tradition of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick. That is really important. One last thing, I'm sorry. I left you with Rabbi Reisner. He and I agree on all of those things. We disagree on two things. We disagree on the more important thing is that the status of artificial nutrition and hydration. Is this like medicine, in which case it may be withheld or withdrawn, that we both agree on, or is this food and water? And everybody needs food and liquids, and therefore Rabbi Reisner says that artificial nutrition and hydration has to be applied and may not be withdrawn ever. So in the Terry Schiavo case, you remember that case? There's a woman who was on life support for 14 years, including artificial nutrition and hydration. He would have said she was breathing on her own, but not being able to eat, and she was comatose anyway, right? He would say that what happened actually should have happened, and she never should have been withdrawn, that artificial nutrition and hydration should never have been withdrawn from her. I would say that artificial nutrition and hydration is medicine because it fulfills some of the functions of food and liquids, but it's not like food and liquids in a whole variety of different ways. It doesn't come into the body the way food and liquids usually do, namely into the mouth and swallowing. It comes in through tubes. As a result, it doesn't have taste, differences in taste, or differences in texture, or differences in temperature, all the things that make food delicious, right? And so consequently, for me, that's medicine. And the decision as to whether you either intubate and put in artificial nutrition and hydration or extubate depends upon the welfare of the patient. You have to look beyond the specific intervention and see it in its context of, is this going to help somebody or is this going to hurt somebody? So we disagree on that issue. The other issue that we disagree on is a little bit of morphine. Morphine is titrated in order to be able to relieve pain. At some point, the amount of, and morphine works by suppressing the respiratory system. At some point, the amount of morphine that you would use or might use, I think this has really changed in terms of pain. There's now a whole specialty within medicine on pain control. But when we were writing this back in the early 1990s, the question is, if a person has a certain amount of morphine and is still in agony, may you use the next amount of morphine even if you think that it might kill the person? He would say no, you may only use the amount of morphine that you know will not kill the person. I would say it depends upon your intention, because morality is not only a function of action, it's also a function of intention. If your intention is to hasten the dying process, then you may not. If your intention is to relieve pain, then you may use that extra amount of morphine. So we disagree on a little bit of morphine. Okay, those are the two places where we disagree. Okay, let me stop now and take whatever questions you have. Okay? Yes, please. Right.
Ministering to the deaf, to those that are dying, and to their relatives, how does your attempt to provide compassion and comfort, if it goes against the theology or the law?
Well, first of all, I'm not an Orthodox rabbi, right? I'm a conservative rabbi. Part of the reason for that is that. But that's not to slam the Orthodox. I mean, there are a whole variety of rabbis of all denominations who are good at that, and some who are not so good at that, right? Whatever denomination, right? Part of it has to do with the things I was just talking about, namely talking with the patient about all kinds of things other than their illness. That doesn't mean you should avoid the elephant in the room. You should actually, you should, if you're a visitor to somebody, you should talk to the person about how that person is feeling about the diagnosis. How do you do that? You don't say, how are you? Because the answer to that is either okay or lousy. That's a conversation stopper. So what you ask is, what did the doctors say? Right? And then what is the prognosis? I mean, what do you think you're facing? And how can I help you in terms of coping with what you're facing? Right? Whom do you want to see before you die? What do you want to have down on paper or on some other recording device before you die? Right? What has given meaning to your life? You know, a kind of retrospect. You let a person talk about what has been important in their lives. Right? What do you wish you would have done differently? Right? By the way, especially for men, I wish I would have spent more time with my family and less at my job. That ultimate thing should teach every one of us, but especially the young among us, priorities in terms. You definitely should do productive work, but America has an idol, and that's called work. We work many more hours than most other cultures do. We sleep far fewer hours than most other cultures do. Neither of those is a healthy way of living. Okay, but back to your question, I think you also, one of the things that at least I've found, is that people who are especially talking to rabbis are interested in, you know, how's God figure into all of this, right? Why am I dying this way, right, is often not so much a theological question as it is a cry for help and a cry for comfort and all of that. But but I've seen rabbis really, really do badly there, okay? And it's in part because they haven't thought a lot of, especially again in the Orthodox world, they haven't thought a lot about theology. And the theology that they have is sometimes really very primitive. I mean, I'll give you a very bad case. This was a family, a young family that was visiting another family, and their toddler, a year and a half, wandered off and drowned in the swimming pool. Okay? And this was a family that was very active in the Jewish community, so there were a lot of people at both the funeral and then at Shiva, the 7 days of mourning that followed the funeral in Jewish tradition. It happened to be that both of them, both of the adults, were former students of mine. So I walked into their home for one of the Shiva calls, and the woman said to me, I have to take you upstairs and I have to ask you a question. I said, okay. It turned out that her Haredi relatives from Denver had come in and had said the reason why this child died is because bad things happen. God makes it so that bad things happen only to those people who can cope with it. And she said to me, do you believe that? I said, no, right? But she was feeling as if, you know, as if the loss of her child was bad enough. But the notion that God should have enabled this to happen in order for, you know, because she could cope with it, it was driving her crazy, right? So, I mean, you have to, there are both the human sides of this and the theological sides of this, and I think we do our best. I teach a lot in rabbinical school. We do our best to try to train rabbis to do this well, but, you know, there are those and there are those. Okay? Yes? Yeah.
And they didn't know, she didn't have an idea on her, and I didn't have an idea on me. They didn't ask me who I was. I could have been anybody. They don't know what her advanced director said. Then the chaplain was going to get a hold of my brother, so the chaplain knew I had a brother. They didn't wait for him.
And what did they do?
They stopped.
They stopped because somebody there was said, stop. That's interesting. Okay. I don't know how, I mean, the doctors here can tell me this better than I know. Exactly how common that kind of thing is. I mean, it depends. You know, doctors and hospitals are worried about things like suits, lawsuits, right, after the fact. And in part because the golden standard in American bioethics is individual autonomy, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What am I quoting? The Declaration of Independence. So I am an individual with rights in the American tradition, right? By the way, in the Jewish tradition, I'm a member of a community with duties. It's almost the exact flip side, right? And that has real implications for healthcare altogether, but for including provision of healthcare, but also for issues at the end of life. I've been on the ethics committee at UCLA Medical Center since the 1980s, and over and over and over again, when it comes to end-of-life issues, the question is, what do the patient want? And every once in a while I say, you didn't give him what he wanted through the rest of his life, so why are you so interested now? Okay, right? But they sort of laugh, and then we move on, as we should, right? But the point is that it's a... at least in the experience that I've had, and doctors here can say one thing, they say, tell me whether I'm right or not, they're usually much more careful about deciding who it is that's making this decision and what authority does that person have to make the decision. And that depends upon state law, by the way. Different states have different pecking orders of who makes the decision when there is no advance directive. See, because as an individual, the patient has rights to determine what he or she wants and what not. Okay, but if the person never made any indication of that, either through an advance directive or at least talking to somebody, the Terry Schiavo case, if the person never made that, then you have a substitute person. And who is that substitute person? Is it, in the Terry Schiavo case, is it the husband or is it the parents? Right? And that depends, it varies from one state to another on those issues. But usually, at least I haven't heard of many cases like yours. And I would hope, at any rate, that doctors would be more careful than they were in your case to determine who it is that's telling me to do this. Yes?
I'm just going to mention something that I find
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Yes, I know. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that's exactly, back to the question that you were asking, that's exactly the kind of thing that hopefully family and friends will come and visit the patient and say, you know, you really, it was a good run. I really appreciated what you did here, there, and elsewhere, right? So that people can say that, yeah, my life was really worth living and may still be worth living. But, you know, I also have to face the fact that I'm mortal. And I don't have a duty, certainly not in the Jewish tradition, I don't have a duty to endure pain. And, you know, so as a result, I mean, even though my life was a good run, let's say, nevertheless, there comes a point at which I need to say goodbye. Right? And by the way, one of the issues of people visiting people is to give people permission to say goodbye. That's the other side of what you're talking about. Right? I'll give you one example of a really terrible case about individual autonomy. This was at UCLA Medical Center. It was a Japanese woman who was completely competent mentally, right, to make her own decisions. She was in her early 80s, if I remember correctly. She, however, refused to make any decisions for herself. The decisions had to be made by the patriarch of the family back in Japan, who hadn't seen her in decades, okay? And you can, I mean, this is really individual autonomy run amok, right? And you can imagine, aside from the medical issues here, the gender issues were blaring, right? All the female nurses were up in arms that this man back in Japan was going to make the decisions for this woman. So you had all kinds of those issues. But in addition, she was mentally competent, and she was consciously saying, I don't want to make this decision. I want somebody else to do it, right? Those are some of the limits of individual autonomy on these issues, right? But it is the American way, and American hospitals are either benefit from it or stuck with it, one or the other. Yes, please.
Would you please talk a little bit about afterlife from the Jewish perspective?
Okay. Let me tell you a story. There was a radio program on KABC, 79 on your AM dial in Los Angeles, in the 1960s through the 1980s on Sunday nights called Religion on the Line, which was a talk show, right? In other words, usually there was a priest, a minister, a rabbi, sometimes somebody from one of the other religious traditions. And people would call in and ask questions. So it happened that, and I was the rabbi every once in a while, right? It was a rotating thing. So one time that I was on this, somebody called and asked you a question, right? What do you believe, not just me, but what do you believe about life after death? So the moderator asked me to go first because the Jewish tradition predated the Christian tradition. So I said, well, we really don't know what happens after death because nobody's come back to tell us, okay? But the rabbis, right, imagine that there must be a life after death in order to solve the problem of evil. How is it that bad things happen to good people? So how can you have a God of justice if bad things happen to good people in this life? One possible answer is that there's a life to come in which all of the accounts are rectified. Okay? So the rabbis believed in a life after death, and as long as they were believing in it, they painted all their values large. Right? Did you guys ever read... Mark Twain's book, Letters from Earth? Mark Twain has this wonderful book in which Satan is banished to Earth, and he writes back letters to his fellow angels. And remember, Mark Twain was a Christian, right? And I think it was the first letter, actually. Satan says, I don't understand why Christians want you know, to live singing on Elysian fields, you know, to harp music. They don't want to do it for an hour a week down here. So why would you imagine a life after death in which you're going to suffer that way, right? Okay. So what the rabbis envision is that what happens in life after death? You don't have to work for a living. We all are pescatarians. We eat from the flesh of Leviathan, this mythic fish. And what do we do all day? We study, except that you have God as your teacher in life to come. You don't have to deal with the weaknesses of individual human teachers. So you study all day. And by the way, the rabbis also ask, what does God do with his day? Did you ever ask that? Well, for a third of the day, all right, God deals with the problems of the world. For a third of the day, he makes matches of husbands to wives. It takes a third of God's day to do that. Okay. All right. And for a third of the day, he teaches Torah. Okay? So they use their imagination to write their values large. But I said, in the end, we don't really know what happens after death because nobody's come back to tell us. And then the priest was next, and he said, oh, but we know. Okay. All right. And then he gave Dante's Inferno and Dante's Paradiso and all of that, right? The Jewish tradition, I should say, believes in a life after death primarily because of the problem of evil, and also because, to give a sense that there is some kind of remainder of a person, even if it's not a physical remainder of the person, in afterward. Interestingly, that only comes into the Jewish tradition in the Second Temple period, in the late Second Temple period. So I'm talking about maybe, let's say, 150 or so before the Common Era, right? Before that time, during all of the rest of biblical history, you get basically when you die, two things happen. Number one, you are you live on through your children. That's why children are so important in the Jewish tradition. It's one of the reasons, anyway. There are many others. To spoil them, for example, and the other way that you live on is through the memory of what you did. Okay, so in the First Temple literature and in the early Second Temple literature, that's what happens after you die. You live on in those two ways. But it's in the late second century, middle second century, actually, before the Common Era, that you begin to get in the Jewish tradition an affirmation of a life after death. When they do surveys of people in America, how many of you believe in a life after death or not, and different groups of people, the last one I saw was only 30% of the Jews that were interviewed believed in a life after death, which is really rather interesting. Whereas evangelical Christians, close to 100%, right? Kenny Chesney, he's a country singer. He's got this wonderful song, I want to get to heaven, but I just don't want to get there now. Okay, right? That's a paraphrase, but that's more or less the point. But anyway, that's what the Jewish tradition believes. Yes, please. Yes.
So you're saying that in Jewish tradition, your body is a gift bestowed upon you, and it is your responsibility to keep up as healthy as possible, but not to impede on your own consider
or delay.
Delay your own death.
Right.
If I fill out one of these
advanced directives. Well, see, certainly according to J. David Blythe, you would be, okay? Even according to Moshe Tendler, in certain cases, you don't have to intubate, right? And so he would allow what you're asking about, but he would not allow you to extubate once you've intubated. I neglected to tell you, the conservative, you know, I told you what the Reform Advanced Directive looks like. The Orthodox Advanced Directive says, I am an Orthodox Jew. My rabbi is so-and-so. I want him to make the decision. Okay? I kid you not. That is the Orthodox advanced directive. Okay? In the conservative directive, what happens is there's a proxy statement first. I want person A to make my decisions if not able or willing, person B, and so on. And then there's a living will. And what the living will is 10 different scenarios that are common to, that are commonly the ways in which people die. If both Rabbi Reisner and I agree, then the various options are all in block print. If he says no, but I say yes, then the part that says yes is in italics. Okay, that's how we did it. We're Jews, after all, right? You know, two Jews, three opinions, right? I did a scholar in residence weekend one time in San Francisco, actually, and this man came up to me and said, "Do you really need two Jews for three opinions?" Right? this is a feisty tradition I'm part of. All right. Anyway, what happens when we allow people not to intervene, that is understood within my tradition as basically letting nature take its course. We're not delaying the dying process. The real issue is, what is the point in which you are, on the one hand, not delaying, and on the other hand, hastening, right? And that's what I meant before when I said that the distinction was much easier to see up until, like, say, the middle of the 20th century. And now, because of a lot of advances in medicine, it's much harder to discern sometimes, okay? But the justification is that you're not delaying the dying process. Yes, please.
So it's Jewish tradition to try and protect your body is as much like how he was saying.
Right.
But I was just wondering kind of what extent that would go to, because it kind of sounds like not to put your life in danger to save someone else's.
Good point.
Right. It wouldn't necessarily kill you to give you a kidney transplant.
Yeah.
How would that be accepted within the...
Yes, good point. I hope you all heard him, right? The question is, does the Jewish duty to take care of your body mean that you may not take any risks whatsoever? And the answer is clearly no, right? Because the risks are... Because life is filled with risks. I mean, literally, you know... I just took two planes today, and I was much safer than when I'm driving a car, right? Statistically, anyway, right? But I both take a plane and I drive a car, right? So I'm taking a lot of risks when I do that. And truthfully, just to walk outside your house, and where do most injuries occur? Within a mile of your house. So don't go home. It's as simple as that. No, what I'm after here is that they're clearly, the Jewish tradition clearly has to allow for risk. Some of them, and in the case of, let's take your case, the case of a kidney transplant, it obviously depends upon how safe it is for you, right? A past president of the synagogue to which I belong had a daughter who had kidney failure at age 30. And she got a kidney from her mother, right? And her mother is still alive and kicking in her late 80s, okay? And really a wonderful woman, by the way. But it depends upon, you know, your own physical health as to whether you can do that. You certainly may, in almost all cases, some exceptions, but you certainly may donate blood. And that is literally life-saving. I do it 4 to 5 times a year. That's the maximum you can do, is 5 a year. Or you can donate platelets. That you can do like once a week, or so, maybe even less than that. If you donate platelets, it's about an hour. It's about an hour and a half or something, and they show movies at Cedars-Sinai. You can pick one. And you get 2 movie tickets and all of that. But the point is that you're saving people's lives. All kidding aside, right? That you certainly can do. Giving up an organ of yours, like your kidney, is obviously much more serious. But it's a risk that the Jewish tradition would allow to take. I'm gonna push you even further. May you volunteer for the army?
I wouldn't know.
Okay. Fair enough. It's one thing if you're drafted, then you have no choice in the matter, right? But what about volunteering for the army? Let's say, especially at a time when we're at war, right? And I think it depends, and there you get a lot of different opinions in the Jewish tradition, I have to say, right? There's no There's no one answer to that. Okay? Yes. Yes, thank you. Both Rabbi Reisner and I would agree that you not only may arrange for your organs to be donated, that's one of the questions in the advanced directive that we created, but that it really is a mitzvah to do that. It's a commandment to do that, certainly after you die. Because one of the things that happens in the Jewish tradition is that we bury very soon after death, but there are two things that can interrupt that process. One is an autopsy, if it's either legally or medically necessary, and the other is organ transplantation. And for organ transplantation, it won't delay the burial at all, because they have to take the organs really right after you die, especially vital organs like hearts and things like that. But yes, at least in the conservative movement, it's not only permitted, but it is really a commanded act to make that possible. Mm-hmm. Yes?
More of a taboo subject, but we talked about like autonomy of the individual,
right,
more towards God. But where does like physician's assisted suicide come into play? Which is again a taboo subject.
No, it's not taboo. I mean, you know, you already have Oregon, Washington, Montana, and California, and Vermont. That allow for physician-assisted suicide, and there may be others, right, that come along the way. I wrote a rabbinic ruling back in 1997 saying that even though I am really quite permissive on what's sometimes called passive euthanasia, that is, standing back and letting nature take its course, on this kind of thing where you are actively involved in and hastening the person's life, that could not be, at least I said at the time, that could not be justified by the Jewish tradition. And what I was worried about, aside from the theological issue that, you know, you're hastening a person's dying, which you don't have a right to do, I was also worried about very practical things. If your insurance company would love to help you die rather than pay for your long-term care, even if that insurance company happens to be Medicare, okay, and you have to, and I don't want the decision to be made on that basis. The other piece of this is that why do people ask to die? We just had a rabbinical student who actually was suicidal. There are people who want to die for all kinds of reasons. Some of them rational, quote unquote, and most of them not. What I'm worried about is that people will say, I want to die. Oh, here's another issue. I want to die because I don't want to squander the family funds. I want to leave them for my children. Right? And therefore I don't want the care that would come along with the long-term care and that kind of thing. Right? Another kind of thing is, I want to die. I want assistance in dying because of the fact that I never really thought that I was worthwhile anyway. Right? You get all of these financial and psychological complications to what started out as being fairly clear, namely, you were going to assist a person in dying in order to quell that person's pain. That's the thing. That's the pure case that we all have in mind, that a person should be able to get assistance in dying if that person is in excruciating pain that cannot be controlled. That kind of case, I think, probably is acceptable, at least in the Jewish tradition. But it's the rarity, right? And by the way, the state of Oregon is the one in the United States that has had the most experience with this. I forgot the exact percentage, but something like over half of the people who got the medications ultimately didn't use them. Right? And assisted dying, by the way, at least up to this point, has been very much a white phenomenon. Very few African Americans, very few Asians, very few Latinos involved in this. I don't know what that says about the sociology of it all, but there it is. Yes?
Could you clarify a little bit more what you mean in the situation where a prisoner gives morphine with the intention to ease pain rather than to kill when they know very well that it's probably will kill?
Yes. That is called the double effect argument, which we frankly got from Catholic moral theology, right? Where the idea is that you know ahead of time that something might lead to two different results, one of which you want, one of which you don't want. And the question is whether you may do it, knowing that the result that you don't want might happen. And basically, what I would say is, again, Rabbi Reisner would only do it on the basis of if it can kill the person beyond what is normally expected, then if we don't have a pretty good almost ironclad guarantee that the next amount of morphine will not kill the patient, you may not use it. That's Rabbi Reisner. I would say that it really depends upon your intention, because I believe that intentions are part of morality as well as actions. And so consequently, if your intention is to kill the person, then you may not. If you may not use that the extra amount of morphine. But if your intention is to cure, is to quell the pain, then you may do it even if you know that that it might kill the patient, because you're doing it out of an attempt to try to save the patient. By the way, risky surgeries, same sort of stuff. Right? I mean, the question is, well, my wife has Parkinson's. She's had it for 10 years, and it got much worse a year ago last summer. This past summer, she had deep brain stimulation surgery. That's basically a pacemaker in the brain, right? That's brain surgery. This is not an aspirin, okay? And it has a certain amount of risk involved in it, and the brain surgeon was really good in explaining the risks, and there's a whole list of them, but he said, and, you know, he's been doing this for 15 years and has not had any one of those events happen. You can't guarantee that it wouldn't happen to her, right? But, you know, you take those risks. Some surgeries are much riskier than that, right? Certain kinds of open heart surgeries and other kinds of stuff, right? May you do those? May you engage in what are sometimes called extraordinary means of trying to save yourself with all of its risks or not? And the answer is yes. If your intention, again, is to try to save yourself, then yes. If your intention is to die faster, no. Okay? Yes.
And speaking about morphine, if a person is allergic to morphine...
Allergic to morphine, yes. I know that pain doctors have a whole series of other ways. I was just hearing about it before this session. We have a pain doctor in our midst. That there are a whole series of other ways in which pain is now treated. It's not just morphine anymore. And so if you're allergic to morphine, they won't use it. Okay?
Does Jewish tradition allow people who already made this advanced
directive
change it?
Of course. Oh, absolutely. Thank you. One of the real problems ethically with advanced directives is you filled it out at age 16 and now you're 85. Okay? Would you have the same desires now as then? Clearly, we can't assume that. So most advanced directives come with a sunset clause, as it were, right? This is my advanced directive for the next 3 years, 5 years, something like that, right? And it either has to be just simply reaffirmed with a date on it, or you change your mind. Sure, absolutely. Okay.
You are really good question askers.
Yeah. Yes, I loved it. Thank you.
I think we're about out of time.
Okay.
And I know Rabbi Dorf got up at
4 in the morning.
4 a.m. this morning with Brian Fly from LA to Boston. He has 3 more lectures you have to give at Des Moines. He'll be speaking at the fair.
One of you wanted love and, what was it? Love and life. Well, tomorrow night, yeah, that's right. Tomorrow night at Tiferet, I'm talking about beginning of life issues. Things like preventing pregnancy through birth control and abortion and generating pregnancy through a variety of different assisted reproductive techniques. So if you're interested in love and life, tomorrow night at Tiferet, I don't know exactly the time when I'm supposed to start.
Well, wonderful questions and an even more wonderfuler
appreciate it.
Presentation. Please join me again in thanking Rabbi Dorf. We'll be back at it again in 3 weeks from tonight. We have a scholar coming from South Africa to talk to us about death and dying customs among the Zulu people of Southern Africa.
I assume we're going to that, right?
You all are going to it.